Well, hey, this is your old friend Bill. Whenever I find myself in Davis, I'm busy putting the fun in fundraising. But when I'm not, I always listen to KDVS 90.3 FM. And you should too. Go Aggies!
This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is a legitimate question. What are we fighting for? We're going to address that a little bit later in the program, along with a lot of what is the news of the day, the news that has to, I think, dominate any public affairs show, which is the ongoing war in the Middle East. I think I would do well to start this program with a quote that was located by my sound engineer, Mr. Edward McMillan, who does his usual fine work for this program, found this on the web, and I think it is as appropriate as any quote we could find, from Teddy Roosevelt. The former president, Theodore Roosevelt, in 1917, said the following, quote, "To announce that there must be no criticism of the president, or that we are to stand by the president, right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but is morally treasonable to the American public." May I remind you that is from Theodore Roosevelt, arguably the second greatest Republican president this nation has ever had. Again, to announce that there must be no criticism of the president or that we are to stand by the president, right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but is morally treasonable to the American public. Now, I think we have to reevaluate here the fact that we're going to be at war for a while, and life goes on. And on this program, one of our goals is to lighten your day as you're commuting home from work or listening on the radio, wherever you may be. And I think we need to do that. We need to go back to doing a little bit of that. So I've got some funny stuff that I want to inject in the program because I think that we simply must. Jill has over the week sent us some very amusing emails, and I want to read you a couple of those that have been backlogged, you might say, for the past month. All right. Top 10 indicators that your employer has changed to a cheaper HMO. Okay? Again, top 10 indicators your employer has changed to a cheaper HMO. Number 10, your annual breast exam is done at Hooters. 9, directions to your doctor's office include, take a left when you enter the trailer park. 8, the tongue depressors taste faintly of fudgesicles. 7, the only proctologist in the plan is Gus from Roto-Rooter. 6, the only item listed under preventative care coverage is an apple a day. Again, top 10 indicators your employer has changed to a cheaper HMO. Number 5. Your primary care physician is wearing the pants you gave to Goodwill last month. 4. Quote, the patient is responsible for 200% of out-of-network charges, unquote, is not a typo. 3. The only expense covered 100% is embalming. 2. With your last HMO, your Prozac didn't come in different colors with little M's on them. And the number one sign you've joined a cheap HMO, you ask for Viagra, you get a popsicle stick and duct tape. I presume we had to thank for that the writers of the David Letterman program. Boys, thank you. All right, next item. Zen Thoughts for the Day, subtitled The Most Wasted Day is One in Which We Have Not Laughed. All right, Zen Thoughts for the Day. Before you criticize someone, you should walk a mile in their shoes. That way, when you criticize them, you're a mile away and you have their shoes. Give a man a fish and he will eat for a day. Teach a man how to fish and he will sit in a boat and guzzle beer all day. If you lend someone $20 and never see that person again, it was probably worth it. Good judgment comes from experience. Experience, of course, generally comes from bad judgment. All right, Zen thoughts for the day. The quickest way to double your money is to fold it in half and put it back in your pocket. There is a fine line between hobby and mental illness. And lastly, among our Zen thoughts for the day, if you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything. All right, and lastly, an email sent to us by Gary Chu. We hope that Gary will join us later in the program. If not, he will be on the program next week. But this was The Axis of Evil Wannabes, essay by Mr. John Cleese, formerly of Monty Python. Many of you may have seen this on the web, but if you didn't, let me excerpt it for you. Bitter after being snubbed for membership in the Axis of Evil, Libya, China, and Syria today announced they had formed the Axis of Just as Evil, which they said would be more evil than that stupid Iran-Iraq-North Korea axis President Bush warned of in his State of the Union address. Axis of Evil members, however, immediately dismissed this new axis for having, for starters, a really dumb name. Right, they're just as evil. In their dreams, declared North Korean leader Kim Jong-il, everybody knows we're the best at being evil. Diplomats from Syria denied they were jealous over being excluded, although they conceded that they did ask if they could join the Axis of Evil. They told us it was full, said Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. International reaction to Bush's Axis of Evil declaration was swift. Peer-conscious nations rushed to gain triumvirate status in what has become a game of geopolitical chairs. Cuba, Sudan, and Serbia announced they had formed the Axis of Somewhat Evil, forcing Somalia to join with Uganda and Myanmar in the Axis of Occasionally Evil, while Bulgaria, Indonesia, and Russia established the Axis of Not So Much Evil, really, as just generally disagreeable. Sierra Leone, El Salvador, and Rwanda applied to be called the Axis of Countries that aren't the worst, but certainly won't be asked to hold the Olympics. Canada, Mexico, and Australia formed the Axis of Nations that are actually quite nice, but secretly have some nasty thoughts about America. Israel, meanwhile, insisted it didn't want to join any axis, but privately, world leaders said that's only because no one asked them. We'll have a special guest today in the second segment of our program. Dr. Lynn Roller, professor of classics and art history, will tell us a little bit about the very interesting history of the area referred to as Mesopotamia, which is better known today as Iraq. All right, on to more serious topics. We'd like to reiterate what we stated last week, that anything that we're going to say in this program in no way, shape, or form should be construed as a lack of support for Americans who find themselves serving in our military overseas. We hope that all of them can return home with an absolute minimal amount of morbidity and mortality. All right, a rather surprising angle to the war in Iraq, I think I should start with. I was unaware of this. I saw it on the Bee, on Sunday's edition of the Bee. The attack that took place in Kuwait at what was called Camp Pennsylvania, where a grenade was thrown into several tents, was evidently perpetrated by a Hassan Karim Akbar, a University of California, Davis, mechanical engineering graduate. He's now in custody for having, I guess, killed two officers and injured several others in what was a rather shocking attack on U.S. Forces by a member of those same forces. Everyone seems quite shocked by this. I'm sure as this story develops, we will try and round out what is a very bizarre and really shocking episode. The Bee article quoted a UC Davis friend of Hassan Karim Akbar, who Mr. Andy McKee, who said that the Iraqi war didn't seem like a good fit for Akbar. He was a Muslim, African-American, and according to Annie McKee, quote, considering his religious background, sympathy for the plight of people in the Middle East, and generally Pacific nature, I can't imagine a worse time and place for Hassan to be than fighting for the army in Kuwait, unquote. Well, the description of this man was of being a pacifist, so something has gone terribly wrong to see him attacking the command structure where he was stationed. Again, we'll try and follow that story. This war in Iraq is now 15 days old, and it's been quite clear, starting about 5 days ago, that things were definitely not going according to plan. Article from The Guardian. Longer war is likely, says U.S. General, contradicting the upbeat assessments from the Pentagon, which repeatedly insisted Operation Iraqi Freedom was on schedule. Lieutenant General William Wallace said his troops had been taken by surprise by Iraqi irregulars using guerrilla tactics. The enemy we're fighting is different from the one we wargamed against, said Lieutenant General Wallace, the commander of the U.S. Army's 5th Corps overseeing ground operations. When asked whether the resistance would lead to a longer-than-predicted war, he said, it's beginning to look that way. Article from the New York Times, reprinted in Sunday's Sacramento Bee, from John Broder and Eric Schmidt. Commanders on the ground report unexpectedly stiff resistance from Iraqi troops and Ba'ath Party irregulars and say it will take longer to remove the Iraqi government than planned. There is an organized pattern of resistance, Brigadier General John F. Kelly, Assistant Commander to the 1st Marine Division, said Friday of the attacks by Iraqi forces. Their determination is somewhat of a surprise to all of us. He added, what we were really hoping was to just go through and everyone would wave flags and stuff. That's a general talking, ladies and gentlemen. Do you suspect that perhaps our military has been misled a bit by estimates of how easy this was going to be? Going on with the article, field commanders complain of dire shortages of food, fuel, and ammunition. They said they have had to adjust their battlefield tactics to handle rear guard attacks and are rethinking the strategy of bypassing cities in southern Iraq. I should note that this is apparently why we have not seen a great deal of change on the battlefield. Apparently right now, the Pentagon is sending reinforcements from the United States, not due to arrive until mid-April. So I don't think we're going to see a great deal of change in the war front in Iraq. Going on with the New York Times article. But the view from the top is different. Here at Central Command Headquarters, where General Tommy Franks is overseeing the conduct of the war, officials insist there have been no surprises, no adjustments, no supply problems. The disparity in views was brought into focus Friday when word reached here that Lieutenant General William Wallace, who we started this article quoting, commander of the army forces in the Persian Gulf, said war planners had not anticipated what he called the Iraqi forces' bizarre behavior. When asked to respond to comments on Friday, a senior Central Command official said only, General Franks believes the plan is on track and on the timeline. Now, Tommy Franks, per this article, had not appeared in the high-tech briefing room since last Monday. This is Monday of last week. Instead, the duty has now been assigned to Brigadier General Vincent Brooks, a young West Point graduate who was auditioned and rehearsed for the role by communications aides assigned to Central Command by the White House. Can we point out to you that how odd it is that the PR machinery has selected a West Point graduate who apparently looks good before the cameras and rehearsed him after auditioning to become the official spokesman for the Pentagon? I think that's a bit disconcerting. Skipping ahead in the article, when Brooks was asked about Wallace's widely reported remarks, he said somewhat implausibly he'd not seen them. But he suggested that a field officer, even a 3-star corps commander, does not have enough information to draw conclusions about the war's overall shape. What does he know? Yeah, I would have to say, what does he know? He's only a guy out there in the field fighting the actual war. Skipping ahead, the descriptions of the war from CENTCOM are leading to grumbling here in Washington about a credibility gap between what reporters see and hear on the battlefield and what the top brass at headquarters is saying or not saying. At his briefing at the Pentagon last Friday, Donald Rumsfeld denied there was any attempt to put out a scripted administration message that downplayed the shortfalls of the campaign's first week. But top communications aides at the White House, Pentagon, and State Department do just that in a daily morning conference call. Pentagon officials say the Central Command briefing operation here was presented as the place to get the big picture, the mosaic constructed from all the little pieces of information from commanders in the field and reporters assigned to military units. But instead of an overall strategic view, the 600 reporters credentialed to the media center have been given video snapshots of the effect of precision weapons and discussions on why information is not available. For example, no one has offered an explanation for the explosion in a Baghdad marketplace on Wednesday in an area of the city where U.S. bombs and missiles were dropped to hit suspected missile emplacements. End of article. Is a credibility gap opening? I don't see how it can't be at this point. The Central Command is telling us one thing. The actual troops in the field are telling us another. While we're getting the reports of fuel, food, and ammunition shortages going on in Iraq, Air Force General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, describes the plan against Iraq as brilliant. The plan is sound, it's being executed, and it's on track. Again, contrast that with Brigadier General John F. Kelly, who said, what we were really hoping was to just go through and everyone would wave flags and stuff. Well, that's certainly what the public was told was going to happen. We don't expect criticism of the Pentagon to be real vehement from Robert Novak. Robert Novak is a well-known conservative commentator in this country. Let me quote from Robert Novak's column, March 27th. There were some who were supportive of going to war with Iraq who described it as a cakewalk, Tim Russert told Donald Rumsfeld on NBC's Meet the Press. The Secretary of Defense seemed surprised. I never did, he replied. No one I know in the Pentagon ever did. While Rumsfeld spoke the literal truth, his response was still disingenuous. It's the source of the cakewalk remark, according to Novak, was not technically a Pentagon official. It was longtime Rumsfeld friend and Lieutenant Kenneth Edelman, appointed by the Secretary to the Defense Policy Board, which we've talked about on this show, which you should be aware of, an outside advisory panel headed by Richard Perle, who we'll have more to say about shortly. In demanding military action against Saddam Hussein, Edelman has promised repeatedly there would be no military difficulty. Novak goes on to be a bit critical for a paragraph or two. And, you know, the coverage that this war was being given in the first few days certainly implied everyone expected it to be over quickly. I think this was the viewpoint of everyone from the top on down. It just hasn't turned out that way. Going on with Novak's article, Edelman and Rumsfeld both overestimated the gap between U.S. and Iraqi military prowess, according to Defense Department sources. Rumsfeld at first insisted that vast air superiority and a degraded Iraqi military would enable 75,000 U.S. troops to win the war. Now, at present, from what I've been able to read, we have about 100,000 troops, and the British have about 25,000 troops. The British seem to have all those troops locked up around Basra, where they're also preventing Iranian incursions into Iraq, and they've been unable to join the forces that the U.S. has amassed near Baghdad. But I want to finish this bit that Robert Novak has to say with the following. Former Assistant Defense Secretary Richard Perle, named by Rumsfeld to head the Defense Policy Board, predicted in February 2001 that Hussein would be gone within a year. I asked Perle whether a major U.S. expeditionary force would be needed. No, certainly not, he replied. I don't think that's necessary. Edelman, Perle's colleague who held important government posts as Rumsfeld's subordinate, was interviewed by CNN's Wolf Blitzer on December 6, 2001. Quote, I don't agree that you need an enormous number of American troops, said Edelman. Hussein's army is down to one-third than it was before, and I think it would be a cakewalk. Since then, Edelman has stuck to that estimate. Now, another word about Richard Perle. He apparently stepped down as the head of the Defense Policy Board over this scandal about his work for Global Crossing. It was not mentioned in most of the articles I saw about Richard Perle getting this minor demotion that he's also under fire from Seymour Hersh, in the current edition of The New Yorker as regards his willingness to broker some arms deals with Saudi businessmen. Now, of course, there's a conflict of interest pointed out by Seymour Hersh in a man who's helping direct the war effort, also reaching out and profiting from arms sales to the same war effort. He's still on the Defense Policy Board. He just, I guess, isn't going to be the head. But I wanted to quote Mr. Pearl. As recently as March 21st, right as the war began, he attended a meeting with the American Enterprise Institute think tank, where he is a, quote, resident fellow, unquote, and said as follows. My impression is the same as I imagine most of you have, that this war is going well and that resistance has been minimal. That doesn't surprise me. I think it doesn't surprise our planners. We've been saying now for a very long time that there are very few people who were prepared to fight for Saddam, and even fewer who were prepared to die for Saddam. I don't know about you, but I'm getting dizzy from all of that spin. We need to take a break, but we will come back to this subject in our third segment today. But in our second segment, we'll be joined by Dr. Lynn Roller of UCD's Classics Department. And we're going to talk a little bit about the ancient history of the land that we are now attacking, which I think is something we should keep in mind. It's a very interesting history, and Dr. Roller will be telling us a bit about it. So stay tuned for that. You are listening to Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Douglas Everett.